He's just sick. And he had this whole half disco ball helmet thing. Like, first time I walked in, and Cog Sunk Lotto and Mammal. I'd never even heard.
Really? Of
that.
So, really? Yeah. Where was that? Where was that?
Blacktown Workers. I'm sure it was.
Full on.
Yeah, it was. It was definitely those three bands. And Ezekiel Ox, and I just remember him making up, they're like doing the whole thing, the disco ball with like rock and roll. I'm just like, and everyone was just, you couldn't even control it. It was just infectious, man. The dudes.
Yeah. Just, I remember. Good. You must have caught him pretty early on. Like, how did you hear about Mammal? Like, did you just catch him?
Because I went and saw Sunkletter on Cole.
Yeah, and awesome. Mammal were there. Awesome. So James and the Mountains crew, I think, did a similar thing. I think that they might have caught him at like a festival or something like that.
And then it's just love. Like,
and then they went and saw them at the Annandale, like the first time they played at the Annandale. And apparently that's this like legendary like gig, like where it was just like this new band. Like, heaps of people were there, and they just blew the place apart.
I said, let's dance right now! I'm not excited that you've fallen behind. I'm not excited that you twisted the line. I'm not excited that there's nothing that's mine. I'm not excited.
And it's actually one of the early EPs. Like, Mammal have released like three or four live EPs, and that first Annandale show is one of the EPs, and it's awesome.
Really?
It's better.
I think I actually bought that.
It's like
that was just the album that was just live, or the EP that was live, was it?
There was like, they've done like two or three EPs that are live. Oh, there were like four or five song EPs, and then they did an album that was live.
Yeah.
And all of those songs, or most of those songs, they then released as a proper production, like recording in the studio production. The live versions shit over them, and it's not that they're bad recordings, it's just that
you feel the energy.
It's something about the live performances. It's funny, like I was over at Mitch's place last night, and I was talking about Mammal. He's like, who? And I'm like, oh, you haven't heard of Mammal.
I would have thought.
And he's like, no, man, there is this gap that he's got with not knowing bands from the time he was overseas in Berlin. He's like, I'm pretty sure that would have been a band. And that's the thing, they had such a short lifespan with Mammal. They're only around for a few years.
Did you ever hear Full Scale?
Well, this is what Mitch was like. Said he was like, is that the guy that was in Full Scale?
Yes,
so he knew of Full Scale, but didn't know that of Mammal. And so I started playing him a couple of tracks. But the thing was, the track that I found on YouTube was an album track. And it was kind of cool, but it was like, this isn't a good way to introduce you to Mammal. Like, the best way would be to either show you a live clip, and even that's not enough, you know? You need to fucking be there, you know?
You feel that, man. Even Full Scale, I saw them with Sunk Lotto again. It was at Evan Theatre in Penrith.
Right.
And it was them, 8 Foot Sativa, I think it was. It's a New Zealand band, I believe. And the same thing, I remember like Full Scale came out, and there's just like, boom, this like really grindy guitar riff that had really gappy.
Yeah.
He just come out and was just like commanding. And I remember everyone was just, I can almost feel it again. Like, the dude is he's born for that shit. Honestly.
Remember frontman material. That gig, I'm not too sure who it was, and he came down into the crowd.
That was the Overreactor show.
And remember, there was like only was about 15 of us, 15 or 20 of us in the crowd. He's coming up right in our face, and I thought I could feel the air coming out of his mouth.
That's awesome.
Like, it's just so confronting. So, holy, I didn't know. You just took me, and I didn't know what it was going to be like.
It was one
and
of the
this
first.
Dude shouting in my face, like, fucking Jesus, it was intense. It was intense.
That was awesome. One of the first Overreactor shows in Sydney, and I knew of Overreactor because Overreactor came out of Mammal breaking up, and it was like, I was so into Mammal, I was like, okay, I'm going to check out Overreactor. And it was weird, like, because it's heaps different to Mammal, but it's awesome. I love Overreactor, and that show was like, I reckon it would have been lucky to have been 15 people. It was fuck all people. Where was it? It was Baldface Stag.
But the whole band would have played like it was Wembley, like what Rob says.
Well, this is the thing. They came out, and it was just like the strut, you know, the fucking Ezekiel Ox just commanding the stage, like, you know, locking eyes with every person. Even though there was only a few people, everyone got, you know, some...
He always means it, eh?
Eye contact. And the first, like, three songs was just, like, full tilt energy. But it was because it's so few people, it's like obviously nobody on the actual front dance floor in this kind of like U shape of people. So Ezekiel just like, and that's right. Remember, he was like, you know, get these like spotlights off me.
Yeah, that's right.
And he got a stool from the bar and he stood up and he's like, you know, moving all the lights so it wasn't just like straight in his face. Yeah. And so, because that's like, you know, super confronting when, you know, if you want to come up to the front of the stage.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like, you know, this like full on light show. It's like, you know, it's kind of weird. So it kind of made it a bit more like, you know, intimate in a way, I guess. And then after like another song of that, he was like, you know, fuck it. And he just came down onto the dance floor and it was just like in it, you know, just fully coming up to people and just fucking singing the lyric in their face and fucking.
Here you go, here's some mammal.
And he just couldn't deny. This is actually the song I played Mitch when we were looking for some stuff. And this is, I think this is the majority.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Okay, so let's get an official start to the podcast here. So, welcome to episode 6 of the Barnsley podcast. We are back, as we promised, with regular episodes. I think it's only been about a week since our last episode's gone up. Want to just thank the new people that have subscribed to the podcast channel on YouTube. It's been a pretty amazing response, actually. Like, we did not expect more than like 10 people to watch this, and the last episode's like clocking up, you know, 50 or 60 views in the last week, which is really cool. I've had heaps of people commenting, like people interacting with us on Reddit and on the Facebook page, and it's really cool. Like, so yeah, it's been inspiring to keep going at it, and so thanks everyone that's subscribed to the channel and is adding comments to stuff, and yeah, it's really cool. The last episode that we did actually was heard by some old friends of mine that have come out of the woodwork and sort of give me a call and said they want to be on the podcast as guests. So yeah,
awesome.
Going to get even more people on. Yeah. So this is awesome.
Hey guys, and thanks for the support. It's awesome. Really appreciate it. And yeah, if you've got any ideas for content or if you want to be a guest yourself, give us a yell or we're open. Thanks heaps for the support. It's awesome. Keep posting on Reddit and Facebook and all that kind of stuff. Big ups to the support and welcome Pete.
Yeah. We've got a new guest today. Pea Sauce is in the house. I've also gotten a little bit of feedback from somebody that was been watching the podcast that our new guests should have a little bit of background introduction on the podcast because our last guests have just been like launching into conversation.
It's
which,
like random dude number 4.
Okay. So let me set it up a little bit here.
Please.
Probably the best way to explain our connection is...
It's P-E Sauce, isn't it?
Yes, and the only uppercase letter is the S.
Oh, okay.
If I'm going by the official rap pseudonym, then
So, yeah, Pete and I know each other because we both play in Age of Menace. Pete's the guitarist, I'm playing bass, and one of these days we'll get the rest of the members in. It'd be good to have a Menace cast one day, don't you reckon?
Oh, yeah, hell yeah, get hell
international
yeah.
Cali.
Yeah, yeah, get some Skype technology
get some
going.
Smith action.
Yeah, yeah.
Some Rob up in here would be great.
So that's kind of like how we know each other. And we originally sort of crossed paths through me being the producer of Age of Menace. Yeah, me and Pete knew each other from back in the days when I had my recording studio, S&J Recording Studio in Artarmon, and we'd do some recording and producing, and one thing led to another. I got roped into being the bass player in the band.
Roped.
We begged him, and he's like, "Nah, man."
I don't know if I want to be in a tank band.
Yeah. Oh no, it was awesome. But like, as I'm sure you remember, Pete, it was like a lot of me calling you and complaining that your riffs are too hard to play, and me trying to get my pinky strength up to strength to be able to, you know, actually use more than 3 fingers playing bass was this whole new concept for me.
Well, not that I want to paint a picture of you at all, Barnes. I think my perspective on how that was, because you're king shit, fully, man, fuck, king shit in terms of recording, and like that's your thing, man. And, yeah, and I think when you jumped into Manus and you weren't king shit straight away, I think you felt a little bit defeated at first.
Definitely.
But I knew the potential, and I yeah, it's just lots of encouragement and just play. And
that's it, man. No, it was good.
And then when we play shows and you go off and everyone's like, your bass player is fucking sick, man. Well,
it was due to a lot of the sort of extra time that we spent together getting those riffs, you know, like there was several hours where you were playing riffs at like a 20th speed for me, just, you know, walking me through the riffs and stuff. So plus I had the advantage of being the producer of the band and having all of the multi-track files.
You would have seen all of these people come through the studio as well, and you would have had this fairly high benchmark of like, oh shit, I at least need to be as good as some of these blokes that come through the studio.
Oh, for sure. You know, and
that would have set a pretty tough expectation.
Oh, definitely. And not only that, I had recorded the bass player previous in the band, Matt Lyon, who is an absolute master of his instrument. He's a really good player.
You both bring very different things to the table. And I'll be the first to admit, at the time, I thought in the previous, you know, Matt always looked up to him as like a mentor, like even just in life, like he was just switched on it and kicking ass.
Mm.
But in the band, I think I always felt a bit of, not massive issues towards it, but I was like, at first, like, we need to get Barnes in because your style is just so drastically different and you're more of like my kind of what I'll, if I have a bass style, but like what I like to listen to.
Yeah, yeah.
But then after when you joined, it was like, wow, I realised when Matt left, Menace did lose something, but then we all gained something different, and you're very different players and you bring different things completely.
It's amazing how much even with some of the songs that Matt wrote and played, when I play them, sound different. So, and I'm essentially playing those same parts, and it shows you how much just different technique, different fingers, different gear as well. I've got a different rig and stuff like that, but it's surprising how much of a in that heavy music, how much of a foundation bass really is. And if you shift it a little bit, change it in a little bit, it can really change the whole feel of the way the band grooves. Sure. You know,
I find it really cool. What I like about it with you, just quickly, like on this subject, like jamming with you is really cool because Matt, and this was the cool thing about Matt though, with Matt, it was like he was just super tight. No matter what, he was on the ball, and he'd be saying, "Dude, you fucked up." You know what I mean? But then with you, I was like, I could just say, "Man, try do this," and you're like, you're always down for it, and you're always down for that different feeling and way of doing it. And that really made the band expand our horizons a lot when you joined. You know, so where we lost a really good vocalist and a really good fundamental kick-assery of Matt, we've gained obviously all your skills, and it's worked out really good.
Opinion. So it's been super fun. We played some fucking amazing shows,
amazing recordings, man. Some of the recordings we've done that and haven't been released.
Stuff. Yeah.
How is your guys' view on the like overseas arrangement? Like, you might want to give some background on how what's going on, or how's it working?
We basically, where the Menace is in a state of long distance relationship, would you call it that?
Yeah.
Where you know, we're still in love, but we're doing it with distance in between us.
Yeah.
So yeah, basically,
I'm not seeing other people.
Basically, most fans of Age of Menace know that Rob, the singer, is relocated overseas. He's got this awesome opportunity with working in the music industry, actually, and you know, obviously, the roads that lead you to the US are usually good roads to take when you're working in that industry, you know. Ooh, so and the thing was is that, you know, it's a good opportunity for the band as well, you know, just having a pair of boots on the ground, you know, overseas to send material to and have somebody to, you know, because we can all do this via the internet and sending stuff, but to have somebody actually over there and, you know, is a really good contact.
A good thing, I think, when traditionally with your band, like, we'll be in the room with someone writing vocals or a singer, and you know what, you got the process. Well, we're sending tracks over and getting back finished works of vocal piece, and it's just like, I never would have thought he would have done that.
Mm.
Oh.
It's cool to be removed from the process because you're giving the artist complete freedom to do what they want. With no,
I couldn't believe how well it worked.
And oh,
the stuff you've been doing, it's been like, was like, so oh my God,
so
it
what
works,
people know
man.
That what we're talking about, the listening, what we're doing is we're still writing as a band. So the remainder of us, drums, bass, guitar, are still. As we were getting together and writing stuff, and we've got now the ability to send those tracks because I'm still got all of the studio gear and the ability to produce stuff to a pretty high level, even when we're doing demos.
Amazing, yeah.
We can send that over to the singer via, you know, files over the interwebs, and Rob's got the ability to track his vocal. Like, he's got, like, you know, the adapters for his iPad to be able to actually plug, you know, a dynamic microphone into his iPad and track using GarageBand. You know, he's told me a few times he's just taken his car for a drive and, you know,
parked somewhere
and screamed into a microphone and then tracks that, sends that back
and
to
somebody
us.
Somebody walks past.
Yeah.
Like, so he said once that he looked up after screaming a big, massive scream, and, you know, he's this jogger that's kind of, you know, looking over going, what the hell is this dude doing? Like,
yeah. So I think it's amazing with the technology now. Like, had you have said,
I'm just going to open my beer. Keep going, Pete.
Had you have said maybe even 5 years ago? 5 years ago, if anyone had said to me, you know, you're going to be able to do a quality, world class vocal track on a little screen tablet device. That's going to be
when you started the studio. If you had said we'd be doing everything like we are now on computers, we would have told them, "Fuck off!"
I would have poo-pooed it.
At least 20 years away.
I would have said no. I would have been very dismissive.
It's not there yet. It doesn't work. You know, it just fucking breaks down.
You could have done it then, but it would have cost you $1 million. Yeah. You would have had dedicated ISDN
lines. Not the way
that
we're doing it now.
You know, we can all use pretty much free services to be able to send these files back and forth. So yeah, we send our ideas over musically to Rob to put vocal ideas onto. He can send us back a mix of that and the individual vocal files that he's recorded in his demos. We can then load that back up into our multi-track sessions and then get really good sounding, you know, mixes out of that. And while, you know, it's not the same as, you know, four people being in the room together, thanks to technology, we can get virtually pretty close to that experience. So
I look at it, yeah, being better, very advantageous. I think it being in a band an annoying thing, but a good thing, depending how you look at it, is the outside influence always. Like, if me and you are writing a song, doesn't matter what you're playing, I'm thinking, what could I do differently? And it's the vice versa, you know, it's just trying to always both of us contribute. But when you just give something to someone and their contribution comes through on it, that's just how it is.
Yeah.
You know, as long as there's no issues with that, I think that's a really natural way to
totally do it. Yeah, and we've still got the ability to react to what then the vocals are done. So the vocals come back and we can still shift the song around, you know, change ideas and stuff like that. So it's still like a very collaborative process.
Very much.
And yeah, it's been really good. So that's basically where the situation with Age of Menace is at the moment, is like a very still in a creative mode, still outputting a lot of stuff. And I guess we could probably crack a little exclusive on the podcast.
And just quietly, I just put up a shot of the Facebook pages or any other places that I can go to.
There's just ageofmenace.com is a good place to go to, you know, get a free stream of all of the material. There's the TuneCore players give you a free play of everything.
Yeah, and you can listen to everything. I think you can unlimited plays.
Is it .com.au or
.com? I think it's just ageofmenace.com.
I can't spell, so don't worry.
I was worried that we didn't pay the domain bill for a second.
No,
here we go.
Yeah, so all of the clips are up there and
How did that send out of that album go, by the way? I never asked you.
Yeah, yeah. We've got that in the mail.
I would have heard about it by Rob if it wasn't. But
I kissed an autograph signature.
Yeah, good.
And put it in there.
Put three panties in there.
But yeah, I was just going to say, we could probably drop a little exclusive on the Barnsley podcast about Age of Menace, is that we've got some new material that we've been working on over the last few months, and we're going to be releasing it probably, I'm hoping, by the end of the year. That's the plan.
Okay.
So, yeah.
It's good. Two guys, I've had a bit of a listen, and it's tank.
Yeah, a forced listen because I've been mixing it about 10 feet away.
I've heard it maybe just a couple of times.
It's really crazy being a guitarist with you and Ads and our drummer. He's a guitarist and a bass player.
To be honest, it takes me back every time. Even when we do something ourselves, it takes me back to when we first started doing the studio, and you start layering stuff, and your dick just gets harder. you start off with something, and you're like, yeah.
You got the half angry happening.
You put something in there, and then, like, you know, and you notice it's just with that stuff we've been doing recently. You evolve over time just through listening to stuff and playing stuff. Like, you know, I'm definitely not on the level of you guys, but, like, you know, you just learn stuff, and it's good to be able to apply that in new ways. And, yeah, when you start layering stuff on, it's just makes you want to go further.
For sure. For me, it's back traditionally. What does that mean? But, like, for me, in my past, I should say, my past experience would be, like, in a writing situation as a guitarist, I'd write guitar riffs.
Mm.
And then the drummer writes the drum beats, and the bass player writes the bass, the singer does the vocals. It's just not like that, man. And, like, the last few songs, the bulk of it, I haven't even written the guitar riffs. And a lot of the times, I haven't even recorded the guitar riffs.
Mm.
And I might just say, oh, maybe try this here, and I might have a bass idea, or as that last song, you did all the guitars, I had one bass idea, and that bit, and, like, that was my contribution to the song. But I'm cool with that. Like, a few years ago, I wouldn't have been
but
cool
is
with
that. But really your contribution to the song, or is your suggestions and your moulding over time also your contribution to the song? Like,
combined with the fact that you can listen to it and just be like, I don't need to add anything else to that, and that's kind of like a contribution, because all of the stuff when you're writing for a band, it's always a hard thing to do. It's like, you know, multiple filters that stuff has to pass through before it's accepted, you know.
I've got an analogy for that. Being in a band is like this. It's like you got a removalist over, and I'm sitting here, and I'm at the fridge there, and they move it there, and you go, oh, no, I want it over there. So they move the fridge over there, and you go, oh, no, I want the fridge over there. So they move the fridge back over there. Then you go, I don't want the fridge anymore. That's pretty much being in a band for me.
I would delete the fridge.
Yeah, just delete it. but that is a modern day band for me, I think.
Yeah, like it's a tough process. But the thing that rings true for me is because I also have the ability to write and record everything myself, but it's always a much more gratifying experience when it's a collaboration.
For sure.
You know,
sure.
Even if it's just you and me, or just, you know, me and the ads, you know, just getting more than one.
More flavors.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And sometimes as that happens, I like to embrace the moments where I'm not sure if I like something.
Yeah.
You know, I'm like, I'm not immediately going to react to that being something I don't like. I'm going to let it simmer, you know?
Totally.
And I'm going to try and find...
That's when the magic happens, I think, man.
Definitely. Because some of those moments, the ones they simmer for a while...
And you need to be able to say...
I never want that to go again.
Yeah.
You know, I never want that to leave the song. That's now a crux moment for me where it's like, it's so awesome, you know? And so that's where collaboration will bring you things that you would not have put in yourself. You might have been... Because you're your only gatekeeper... It might have gone on the edit floor way early.
Mm. Or but somebody might have gone. Something's fully shit, and then someone's, you know, all it needs is something. And
how many
or
times?
Vindication.
Mm. Even just when you and I write something, how many times has one person done a part, and they're like, give me another go? And the other person's like, dude. That was so awesome. You cannot do that again. I'm keeping that one.
That happened to me last night recording with my mate Dean for his uni project.
Really?
Yeah. He done this thing and he's trying to... Oh, just probably in a bad podcast. Anyway, he's done this thing and he fucked this bit up. And like fucked it up in his mind. And I'm like, oh, you changed where the one was
playing
in the bar.
Guitar?
Yeah, sorry, man. We're recording guitar.
Yeah.
And it was magic. And he goes, oh, this shit. I said, listen to it again, man. He goes, yeah, it's wrong. I said, no, just let go of what you were trying to play and just listen.
Yeah.
He goes, that's sick. I went, yeah, man.
And that's kind of like the other night we were doing that thing. And, like, we had a chord progression going over, like, a lick thing. And it sounded okay. And then we recorded those bits and I did, like, a little trilly bit over the top.
Yeah.
And it was like, fuck, that's it. That's it. Next song. And then we untracked it. Oh, that's right. We stopped it and we just tried to play it. And there was three parts in the song, and we just tried to play the two parts, and we're like, man, that sounds wrong. sounds like it's out of tune or some shit. And then we played it again along with the song. No, we're back.
Yeah, totally.
It's like, what the fuck?
And it's, like, just, it's like interesting, like, you can... Excuse me, beer. You can get, like, a lot of these games, like Guitar Hero and games that...
The other one, that new one?
Rocksmith, which we've been playing, which is great. Awesome. But a lot of those games, the way that they work... They actually go to the artists and say, we need the multi-track files so we can, like, turn things up and down. When people, like, stuff up a note, we can stop it and, like, play a plink and stuff like that. And that's enabled a lot of songs. You can go and find, like, a torrent file or whatever that will give you the multi-tracks of popular songs. And, like, it's only a recent thing in the last, like, sort of 5 years or so that you've been able to do this. Forever, it was just that stereo mix that was released that you would have to try and figure out
EQ something out of it or whatever.
How things sound, individually. But now you can find the stem files, a lot of these songs. And what I found when I found a lot of songs, like there's Nirvana songs and shit that you can get stem files for, songs that I've listened to for fucking decades. And then I've got the ability to strip that out and listen to just the drums, just the bass. Man, it's been such a shock to me. And it's taken my engineering to another level to hear just what a bass sounds like in solo. And then turn on the rest of the band, and what I thought was a fucking naff bass sound, like a shitty bass sound, just works like fucking magic. And then all of a sudden, that's the sound. I've been listening to for 20 years. And then I solo it again, and I'm like, man, if you had sat me down in front of a mixing desk and said, you've got to mix Nirvana's bass tone, that's not the one I would have pulled. But I would have been wrong because that is the bass tone that fucking works.
It's
in
like
that song.
Mixing metal guitars, like isolate them, and it's tinny and,
Shitty. Totally.
Especially after our recent like discoveries in that.
And you realize how much weight the bass brings to metal guitars. The bass, you know,
and,
like
and as I've always maintained, the bass is where it's at for all rock/heavy music. It's where it's at, man.
Have you heard of a guy called Glenn Fricker? He's this guy that's a metal engineer. He's got his own recording studio. And he's recently become a bit of a YouTube fame because he's done these, like, parody videos, like, just abusing the shit out of metal bands that come into his studio that are unprepared. And
is that the long-haired dude that we watched?
Yeah.
That
was he's a fucking awesome cat, man. He's
you can't deny what he's saying, man. Like, after being just a irregular visitor or assistant at studios, I notice it. It's like, how the fuck are you spending all this money... And you're throwing it down the fucking drain, man. Like, it's stupid.
By not being prepared or having your gear out of fucking, you know, not in good spec. You know, I can tell you a million horror stories, and that's why those videos were, like, half funny and half goddamn true, like, you know. Anyway, the reason I bring him up is we were talking about bass and the importance of bass in metal. And his latest, the thing with all of his other videos is that he just goes off as, at bass players. He's like, they fucking suck, man. There's nothing that will fuck your record up faster or your recording session up than a fucking bass player. they are fucking failed guitarists that fucking, you know, that are just hiding under the fucking sound of the band. And until they get into the studio when they're exposed and they actually matter and their tone is fucking there for everyone to see, they fucking... They're shit, you know, and he's kind of saying that like to overdo it, to go kind of ha ha ha, but at the same time, but it is true, and he'd made a new video that just focuses on all of the shit that he's given bass players, because I think that's the number one rage in the comments in the videos and stuff. He's like, you know, I'm a fucking bass player in a metal band, and I'm good, man. I fucking practice and fucking da da da. You know, not realizing that, you know, if you're taking his comments seriously, you probably are shit.
Yeah, exactly.
Probably and if you don't take it seriously, you probably are aware that it is true.
Yeah, totally.
In a way, you know what I mean? But yeah, quality videos. I recommend you check it out. I'll link you up, and we'll link on the podcast to his channel. You accepted my friend request on Facebook, which is pretty cool. Yeah, not just like a following. You know, when you're actually one of the. Mm. I think Facebook's got a 5,000 friend cap.
I've heard something similar. Yeah.
So if there's a celebrity on Facebook,
that'd be verified or something, and then they can.
I think that's Twitter verification. I don't know if Facebook's got.
Big up on this.
That's a problem with Facebook, man, is that there is a lot of fucking rogue accounts. Like, for example, Joe Rogan, he's not active on Facebook. He does actually have one...
he's not really active on YouTube either. It's other people that post shit.
Yeah, yeah. You
know, totally. It's not an official
thing. It's Redband or Jamie, the two assistants to the podcast.
Do they do that powerful JRE account?
Yeah, yeah. That's an official Rogan account, JRE account. But on Facebook, he does have one account which is purely used just for... comedy dates. There's no podcast posts on there. There's all of these fucking random ones. Like, there's one for Joe Rogan Questions Everything, the TV show that he had on Sci-Fi. Oh, that's got its own Facebook page. Yeah, yeah. Then there's the Joe Rogan Experience Podcast. That's the name of another page. And then that's not actually anything to do with Rogan, but the people that admin that page come out and say that regularly. They're like, look, we aren't affiliated with Joe Rogan. Basically what they do is they keep their eye on Joe's Twitter all day and they repost his Twitter stream on Facebook. So it is pretty much legit Rogan posts. It's just that Rogan doesn't post that shit on Facebook. He does it on Twitter, and they're like a service of a reposting to Facebook. Yeah.
Okay.
So that's why I follow that page, and it's cool. But yeah, Facebook's, I don't think it's got like verification or, I don't know. I don't know if there's like a way for you to be like the official page of
I'm pretty sure the page putting Lars Ulrich's face on things, I'm pretty sure Lars runs that Facebook page. If you haven't seen it, putting Lars Ulrich's face on
it's pretty funny.
It's not even funny, but it's funny. It's
Lars Ulrich's face on Lars Ulrich is pretty fucking funny.
There's always a part of me. When I first got into like music was Deep Purple, and then naturally from there like it was like Metallica.
Your first music.
First music was...
would you say that was the first music you discovered outside of the music that your parents introduced you to, Deep Purple? Because that's pretty fucking cool.
My first ever concert in my whole life, I was in year six, so like however old you are in year six, right? And I went to the Deep Purple concert in the entertainment center with my mate.
That's
was also
cool.
In year six. And
don't talk about first concerts.
I'm getting round to that. Oh, don't fuck you fucking worry. We're all going to tell our
is
story.
Is this what you're talking about, guys?
Wait, don't worry. I'm remembering this. That is podcast people.
Putting Lars Ulrich's face on things.
Is that like Hank from fucking...
That's sick. And that's...
Nicki Minaj fucking... Have you seen the fart remix of that Anaconda?
This is piano.
Some of them are done really well too. Like people put serious hours into it.
Some Photoshop skills are pretty awesome.
Savages.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure Lars runs that page. It's official. It'd have to be.
Yeah, because he's got such a good sense of humor about that kind of stuff.
Doesn't he?
Takes it on the chin, you know, like a champ.
He takes it on the chin, alright.
You have to go and speak to his fucking resident fucking psychiatrist that he pays fucking whatever amount per day.
Oh man,
you know that dude in that video?
Some kind of monster.
I so wanted to punch that dude.
I
sandwich, and he's like, I don't know. It's your job to know, mate. You get him.
We'd never understand that whole kind of thing. That's just massive money and lots of pressure.
Massive egos.
For sure. But with that, wouldn't...
Massive success.
I could be wrong here, but wouldn't it be to a point...
Massive expectations.
That's what I mean. You know? So you kind of, to a point, have to carry ego fairly high. I would imagine, anyway.
We're going to talk about Metallica in a second, but we're not going to get past their first concerts.
Okay.
Now, I'm bookmarking Metallica. I want to talk about that. That's a cool documentary, Some Kind of Monster. You were saying that Deep Purple was your first concert.
Yeah, so I was young and my mum's friend bought over a vinyl. And my parents got me into, I can't even remember what they called it. We got our first compact disc player, I was young. And what's that? Dire Straits and the Proclaimers and like that whole that's different, very worlds apart.
Dire Straits is awesome. That's one of my first early albums. That was not the period that I was outside of the music that my parents were handing down to me, but I was lucky that my parents had a pretty good taste in music.
So you just
I considered Dire Straits a pretty it wasn't decent. Like it was like, here, listen to this. It was an album that was in my parents' collection that I latched onto.
Me too, to a point. But then my mum's friend bought over a Deep Purple vinyl,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't know. She was like, you'd really like this, Pete, because I was just learning guitar and, like, the Blues Brothers theme and, like, Christmas carols and shit like that, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And then, and I haven't really, I hadn't heard Metallica yet, or I was just, like, you know, young kid. And then Deep Purple vinyl, and then I put it on, and I was just, like, it was a, I think it was Made in Japan vinyl, their live thing. And then I remember hearing some guitar solo, I'm just going, oh, and I remember the feeling, it changed my fucking world with music, man. And
yeah.
I'm just getting excited thinking about it. It was amazing.
And awesome.
Then it was about a year or two later.
Which album was it?
Made in Japan, I think it was. Okay. It was a live album.
Yeah, right.
And I've actually bought the CD recently.
Yeah, right. I was going to ask you, is it something that you've still got and listened to?
Yeah, very good.
Get that juice flowing
amazing,
again.
Amazing, man. Yeah, and then when I went and seen them live, and it was just, oh.
See, okay, this takes me on to a... Sick. Okay, I can't leave it go. That was your first concert, Deep Purple.
Yeah, man.
Brewer 74. What was your first concert?
I'm trying to think. Yeah, actually, my first one.
Oh, let's get some. I don't know what the go is here, but I can tell it's juicy.
It's not good. It's cold. Was it the first one?
I'm sure it was.
I'm sure it was. Pretty sure it was. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was in Hong Kong. I'm gonna get I'm not a fan of Roxette.
Roxette, ladies and gentlemen.
Right now,
Roxette.
I'm not a fan of Roxette. The only reason I went is because I went with their hot stepsister.
Yeah.
That's the real, I'm really
that
fucking
totally,
reason I
yeah,
went.
That's a heaps better explanation.
Oh, fuck off, man.
You gotta edit the fuck out of that in post.
I've got stories about that stepsister and you that I'm saving. So fucking fuck ya. But
that's all music, man. Like a live band of any band. You can
nah,
go
it was
see
so shit.
Like,
that
is sick.
Right, you know what I remember? There's two things I remember from that concert. And I was pretty fucking young, but there's two things that glare out at me. Mm. She came out with no fucking shoes on. How much are we fucking paying? And
you
coming
grub.
Out? You got fucking go back home to fucking Scandinavia and dance around in your fucking
80th.
Dirty
that's
fucking
80th
black
show
fucking
sole
shoes.
Break,
you can fuck off. And the other thing is that dumb fuck with the guitars.
Yeah, we'd always wear glasses and sunglasses
racket.
Inside.
Yeah. The trench coat.
Yeah.
Fucking massive rack of guitars. And I just started playing guitar, and that's what I was looking at. I was like, oh man, look at all that fucking tang. He used two. I kept that. That's all I was. Because I wasn't listening and I wasn't really watching it.
Maybe
anything.
It was. Like, was one of those two guitars a keyboard guitar?
Yeah.
Like guitar. Maybe it was like the Spinal Tap video clips where you got these fake Marshall cabs. Maybe they were just fake guitars. They weren't real. And they just lined up to it.
It was just hollow and part of the frame that they're in. Like, if you picked one up, you'd pick this whole frame up of like a prop.
Yeah. You pick one up and eight come with it. Like,
look, Rock said it's okay. That wasn't like your choice. That wasn't like, they're coming.
No,
I'm going to spend my money
on
a ticket.
I had a free ticket, and my mum was like, it'd be really cool if you went.
And there
wasn't much on in Hong Kong. You don't go many. Anything, so I was like, whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
But
I'm trying to
music
I'm,
boys.
I'm trying to remember what my very first live performance was. It's hard to tell because our father is a professional musician, and we just went to so many gigs. And
yeah, that's what I mean. Like, surely I went to something before that.
Because you know,
I just
like,
don't realize.
Nah, you got to keep it at Roxette though.
if you're talking like, you know, officially, what first gig I went to, it would have been one of those gigs.
Gunners, wouldn't it?
No. That Dad played. Like, you know, Dad played that gig in Warrnambool. I don't think you were born.
I wasn't around.
But you know, I guess that would be officially my first gig. But I'm trying to think. It would have been. I'm thinking it might have been like the first big day out.
Sick.
Because I was
Nirvana
really young, yeah.
Well, you went
really
to Nirvana
young.
Before you went to Gunners?
No, you're right. Guns N' Roses was probably at Eastern Creek.
I remember when that was on. And I didn't go. I just remember it being
on. So wanted to 90, go.
I think it was 94.
Yeah, I was way too young.
And it was...
It was before we went to Hong Kong.
Yeah, I was 9.
It was pretty epic. I've got a couple of funny stories from that concert. I went with a bunch of friends, and one of my friends was notorious for like being a bit of a flake, like crashing out when it was too boring. You'd just be like, I'm going to sleep, you know, wake me when something interesting's happening. And we went. The thing was is that like, and they told people, you know, like, you got to be there at like 10 o'clock in the morning. It was ridiculous, man. And I think it was because it was
Rose Tattoo.
It was one of the first times, like probably not one of the first times, but certainly one of the first times Eastern Creek had tried a big concert like that. I'm sure Sydney had had big shows, but this was like the first time that venue had done a big show like that.
From my understanding, and I wasn't part of the, I wasn't really aware at the time, but I think didn't Gunness have like a bit of that whole evil against society kind of vibe that people didn't like as well?
The whole moniker of Gunners at that time were they the most dangerous rock and roll band in the world.
And Axl's
and
dangerous,
part of that reputation came from their part of that reputation came from their volatility, and that volatility means that they'd cancel gigs at a drop of a hat. They'd be fucking late as fuck to, like, you know, appearances
Axl's
and stuff
just, like
that.
Yelling at people like a goose at every
You show. Don't want to fucking piss him off. There was this famous thing. I remember one of my favorite fucking interviews with Kurt Cobain is when he's being asked about what he doesn't like about that fucking big LA glam rock fucking rock star attitude. And he's like talking about how, man, they just live in a different world, man. They just live in a different world. They'll come out of a plane and they'll say to their manager, you know, I want a line direct from the plane to the limo. No video. Line direct to the limo. You know, like, and that's just that douchey kind of fucking, you know. What was I talking about before that? Why did I get onto
Gunners?
Yeah. So I think, you know, that's where their volatility came from. This real, like, you know, I think Axl was a prima donna, you know, very fucking, you know, a lot of details about, you know, specific details about, you know, no video and fucking I want this on my gigs and, if you know, this is my agreements aren't met, I'm not appearing, you know, and
did
all
you hear
this kind
James
of shit.
And, talking about him at one of the, when they toured together in the 90s, and James Hetfield, one of the Metallica fears and bags Axl out.
Well, that was that big 90s tour where it was
both of them.
Yeah. It was somebody else as well, I think. Was it Pantera or
no, Guns N' Roses, Metallica, Joe or something, or one of them?
Right,
wasn't it?
I think you might be right.
Judas Priest.
No, I think you might be right. Ugly Kid Joe or something like that.
Yeah, it was one of the,
What did Hetfield say about it?
Oh, he gets the hold of his rider. He's just reading out his rider, and he's just like, and I forget exactly what it was. You know, I got to get like cubed ham or something. It's like, and I just like. Just hacking shit on
you. That's funny. I'll talk about writers in a second, but I'll just finish my story about my mate that fucking falls asleep when everything. So anyway, they tell the people to get there at like 10 o'clock in the morning. I think it was because they weren't really prepared for the logistics of that many people. So they were telling people to get there heaps early so it wouldn't be this big rush and shit. So it was fucking packed by like 10, 11 o'clock in the morning. It was the hottest motherfucking day.
I remember it was fucking hot.
It was the hottest day and there was no shade. It was like just everyone out in this paddock in the bare sun, man.
So far there have been two arrests. Police expect more trouble tonight.
Eastern Creek Raceway has been transformed into a sea of black. Tens of thousands of heavy metal fans shaking and jumping to the warm-up bands. It's a time bomb waiting for the bad boys of rock and roll to explode onto stage.
And the fucking, like, there was two support bands. It was Rose Tattoo and it was Skid Row.
Oh, right.
And I'm pretty sure that they decided to put the supports on early because it was just getting ridiculous, man. People were getting so bored. Like, I'm pretty sure that the first support was Rose Tattoo and they didn't come on till probably 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So there's
4 hours in the sun. Or
dude, yeah. People just drinking. You know, people getting bored, people fucking
fights and stuff, right?
Here's how it started, right? So just let's start the story with my mate getting too drunk and going, I'm going to sleep. And he's just falling asleep on the ground.
Yeah.
Right? Shirtless. That's a key point. Shirtless. And for people who aren't watching, with his arm, one arm across his eyes. So hang it's on, like a sleeping mask. So like, you know, like this. Yeah, and just falls asleep on the ground. He's gone, right? He fell asleep by like midday. So the crowd's getting more riled up. They're getting more drunk. They're getting impatient. You know, there's occasional people coming out on the stage making announcements and stuff, but there's really no entertainment at all, you know?
For some, the push and shove proved too much.
A couple of collapses, exhaustion, a few heat problems. and it's just because they were here far too early.
Months of planning have gone into the concert, with special precautions being taken to handle the huge crowd.
So the fucking human pyramids start.
Oh,
people start fucking making massive human pyramids. Like, we're talking like the bases of them were huge. And they would go, I remember there was a couple of them that I saw that were at least 10 people high. So like base, then the next level, then people on top of that level, people on top of 10 up, and the dude would get to the top and fucking he would have like a big gunner's skull flag and he'd like wave it when he got to the top of the pyramid, the whole place would be like, yeah! And that just egged on other motherfuckers to do it.
Yeah.
And then the pyramids would be getting so high and the dude that was flag waving at the top would be cheered on by the crowd to fucking jump off the top.
Yeah.
So he was jumping off these pyramids, and then they came out and they're like, you know, making announcements, you got to stop that shit, you know people are going to get hurt, and I'm sure there was people that fucked themselves up hard.
Okay.
You know?
Jesus.
Then the fires started.
It was great, it really was.
Throughout the afternoon, things ran smoothly, but as night fell, the crowd became restless. The lighters came first, and then the fires. One woman had to be taken to hospital, suffering severe smoke inhalation.
But when 80,000 people get bored, they want to do something, and lighting fires is as good as anything else.
So people started making bonfires just in the middle of the fucking crowd. Like, I don't know where they were getting the wood and shit, but there was these massive fires, and like, you just see the crowd part, and then fucking a fire would be there. It was fucking crazy. That didn't actually happen until it got dark. So Rose Tattoo came out probably, late afternoon. They played it. It was a fucking awesome set, and people were fucking keen as for anything, you know. They'd been drinking for fucking ages in the sun.
Yeah.
My mate, still asleep, didn't wake up for Rose Tattoo. Still asleep. And then this whole time, these human pyramids and shit, people jostling. I'm sure he got his face stepped on 10 times. Nah, he didn't wake up. Fucking Rose Tattoo played. There, that was done, and the crowd's just getting more rowdy, you know. All that they needed was a little bit of music, and then shit's getting real, you know. Sun's starting to go down. I remember fucking thinking, I've got to wake my mate up. Like, he'd probably, and he was like a bit of a fan of Skid Row as well. He probably wants to see Skid Row's set. Took us ages to wake him up. I'm pretty sure it took water on the face to wake him up.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget when he fucking woke up. He took his arm away, and there was just this line, man. He was so burnt, like beyond anything. Like, it was third degree burns, man. There was like already you could see the band of where he protected his eyes with his arm. This is Neil Conway, by the way, who you know.
Man.
It's an old mate of mine from high school. I just gave away his name on the podcast.
Well, you knew I haven't spoken to him.
Edit that out.
So then Skid Row comes out and fucking... That's right. That earlier in the afternoon, once the pyramids started forming, they cut off the beer.
That's not a good idea.
They cut it off after Rose Tattoo were playing, and there was an announcement. They're like, that's it. Until... So it wasn't like there's no more beer. It was like, until things settle down, there's going to be no more beer served. And people are like, fuck that. And it just got more rowdy and shit. And then Skid Row came out. And I remember Sebastian Bach, the first thing he did was to fucking come out. He's like, they won't let you have any fucking beer. That's fucking bullshit, man. And he like runs backstage and he brings out this like, fucking man, it was like a 24 slab of like tinnies.
Yeah, and he's talking about
it. And he just rips it over. He starts chucking them out of the crowd. They're like, woo! Like, as if that's going to fucking quench anyone's
thirst. There's so many fistfights over those cans.
And they're fizzy fucking nightmares by the time they get the fucking people.
Knocks some
you know?
Dude out. He's going in the barn. Just bang! Oh, fuck.
And Skid Row played, and I'm pretty sure that the crowd settled down because of the threat of no beer, and they were serving beer again, but it was a nightmare. It was so not set up. Like, you had to traipse through this fucking field of fucking people to find these fucking shanty town bars that were nothing like the facilities we have at festivals now. And some would say even the festivals are pretty shit setups as they are now, but they are fucking light years ahead.
They herd you into those fucking pens.
Oh, the drinking pens at the early sound waves.
Fucking dumb.
Yeah, they don't do that anymore.
They
thankfully
don't do that anymore.
No, they don't have the drinking.
They just give you half strength drinks.
They give you half strength,
Yeah, isn't there strength drinks at Sound?
I'm pretty sure.
I remember buying heaps one day, and when you're in the Aussie sun and you're drinking like proper, it's depending how you look at it, it's normally not good.
It's crazy.
And then you can just drink all day there, and it's just getting sugar highs from.
So fucking Skid Row finished their set. They started serving beer again. And Gunners played, and it was a top concert, man. It was really good sound. Fucking, it was weird because we were fucking so sunburnt and like had been drinking all day, and by the time it actually came on, it was like you'd run a marathon, and then it's like now we've got to fucking get into this kind of thing.
Yeah.
But it was fucking cool. It was really good. They played, you know, all of the hits. And they did like an encore and shit. It was weird. There was a point where I don't know if it was planned, like that whole thing I was talking about, how they were a like volatile band, always on the edge, most dangerous band in the world. They played a song and the fires were starting up again during Gunner's set. And it's just like at the end of a song, it was just like, "Good fucking night" from Axl. And he's thrown the microphone into the crowd. And you just heard it go, foo, 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 like looping through the air. And fucking, I remember hearing the fader of the desk come down before it hit the ground. But it just landed into the crowd. I'm sure somebody's just got it in it. And everyone's like, looking at each other. It's like, what just happened? Is that it? Like, has Axl just gotten the shits and just chucked the microphone? And there were still a few key songs that hadn't been played yet.
And after a whole day, you'd be
fucking the whole band went off the stage and fucking lights went off the stage and I'm like, oh man, what is that? Yeah, no fucking way. It was awesome, but fuck, they didn't play like they didn't play Knocking on Heaven's Door, they didn't play Paradise, which was their traditional closer.
You gotta
That was their tradition. Like all of their concerts from that era, Paradise was the big finale. So I was like, what the fuck's going on? And people were like, ah. And the fucking promoter guy came back out on stage, the guy that had been doing all of the fucking announcements. He's like, the band will not perform until fucking those fires go out. You know? And it was a good 20 minutes, hey, like until they came back on. They came back on, they did another like three songs. They did like Knockin', I think it was Sweet Child, and then Paradise. And it was like epic. And I read an article years later. And they were heaps late going on as well. And I read that it was like some demand from Axl about needing to be flown in on a helicopter. Like he wouldn't play the show unless they flew him in on a helicopter. I don't know if that's true or not. I don't know if I completely pulled that out of my ass.
You can't do vocal warm-ups below 1,000 feet. You just can't do it. Man. It's not on.
I'm pretty sure Gunners would probably count as my first concert that I went to. They're like, I want to go to that concert, and I bought a ticket for it. And went to,
Do you remember the very first album you bought with your own money that wasn't given to you?
That's probably pretty embarrassing.
And it is mine. I remember mine and it's embarrassing.
Yeah.
Mine is, but my second and third kick ass, so it redeems it.
Am I going first? You did ask me. I'm pretty sure the first album I bought with my pocket money was a Cliff Richard album.
Cliff Richard?
Yeah.
That's not too bad.
I'm going to beat you even your live first gig.
Well, I don't know. And I think it might be, I don't know, because I had Richard Marx, which you wrapped around me and took a photo of me of. And I loved that fucking tape. And I was in tears and bawling my eyes out and he's wrapping it around me. Trying to tie me up, and he took a picture of me. Bawling my eyes. I was like fucking fine.
Crying in that photo.
Yeah, I'm like, tape all over my face and over my mouth and shit. Fucking cunt.
You're trying to put it back in. It's still good. It's still good.
I think that. Fully, man.
You're a bad brother.
Oh, well, it's 5 years difference. It was bound to happen, but. Yeah, it's like, you know, I think that was given to me, but I do remember going and buying Tears for Fears on tape.
What? It reminded me.
Tears for Fears?
They are pretty shit, but at the same time, they've kind of had a. You don't know Tears for Fears?
I know the name. I do, but I don't. Like.
Ding a ding 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 ding.
You know, Triple M smashed the fuck out of that for like 20 years. I'm pretty sure they still play it every day.
Everybody wants to rule the world. That was their big big song. They had other songs too.
I bet the clip's not much easier. So did you have the whole full album?
I remember, I'm pretty sure it was this song.
So I had Tears for Fears song on. I remember the compilation tapes. Or CDs,
hits of '99 or whatever.
You get like the compilations, like the hits. I had hits of 100%
hits.
87 right on track.
Oh, Daryl Braithwaite.
And it had could you just Google 87 right on track? And if you can bring up the album cover for that, it'll be such a reminiscent memory trigger for me. I reckon
that's the way it's gonna be, little Barnsley.
I don't remember that.
Little
bones.
You gotta grit your teeth when you
see
it.
We'll go
round.
It's one of them. Yeah. Just get images. Yeah. See if there's a. Oh, there it is. There see, it is. It's a road sign. It's a fucking like a road. Oh man. See, that's probably one of the first albums I actually bought. Not Cliff Richard. Go. Probably.
It's on screen.
Probably that one, and it had. Sure. Let's just have a look at some of the songs on it. Wah Wah Nee, What Quality, Breakfast Club, Wang Chung, Wang Chung tonight. Everybody have fun tonight.
I know the Pretenders and Huda Gurus. That's all I know. On
who the fuck's Melon Kim?
Oh, it's Europe. A lot of cheese.
Who was Breakfast Club? What did Breakfast Club do? I know the name again. I don't know.
I couldn't tell you what song it was, but I bet you if you played that song, don't play that song or that album on YouTube, but I bet you if I listened through.
What was it? Breakfast what?
Breakfast Club?
That's the famous movie as well, The Breakfast Club from the 80s, which is like Molly Ringwald and Judd Nelson.
The amount of shit that comes up.
Isn't it the one where they're all in detention together? And it's like they all fucking emo out. During detention.
I think I've seen that.
It's a super popular movie. You know, it's like Pretty in Pink.
It was 80s. Like the kids' movie of the time. Emilio Estevez
was in it. I was about to say,
he's Charlie Sheen's brother.
Have you seen
Young Guns?
Did you see the Charlie Sheen roast?
Oh yeah,
Comedy
that's
Central
fucking
roast.
Awesome.
No,
and it's fucking,
it's fucking awesome.
Patrice O'Neill was one of the roasters. Man, it's one of the best roastings I've ever seen in my life. The Patrice O'Neill roast, and he's like, you know, he actually hacks all of the other fucking roasters apart. But when it gets to Charlie Sheen, he's like, look, you know what, Charlie, you know, I actually respect you, man. You know, you stood up to the industry and you showed that ain't nothing can keep a Sheen down. Nothing can keep a Sheen down. So it sure can keep a fucking Estevez down, though. That dude's career is fucking over.
Fucking hell.
Here we go.
Because they're brothers. I didn't realise for ages that Emilio Estevez. Yeah. Why do they have different last names? I don't get it. Like a lover with a different mother? Brother with a different mother? Is that
maybe it's just a pseudonym or
in front of him in a theatre.
You know what? We will totally get flagged.
I'll stop it there. We'll put a link in the description.
We've been YouTube's got some amazing algorithms. Whenever we've been playing other YouTube videos,
it knows.
It auto senses it. Like within, like as soon as we've uploaded it, it's flagged and it knows, and it lets you keep that content up.
And just warns you or something.
It just goes, you got to acknowledge it. So it's like a button that says, "Okay, I got it." And you click that, and I think that then negates any monetization you can do from the video. Either that, or if you do monetize the video, you've got to share the cuts
with the person that owns
the other YouTube videos that you've put in with it.
Okay.
So these are all the things we're learning as we do the podcast. It's an interesting little anecdote.
And if you've got
actually
tips as well, guys, like, you know, send them our way. Always open for tips and suggestions, sponsors.
I'm just going to get another beer. Do you want another beer, Pete? Or a beer, Pete?
From a coffee to a beer,
it's too easy. I like the way you roll.
From the seeds of the bee to the double OB.
So my first album.
Yeah, that you bought with your own money, man.
Okay, keep in mind, when I was young, I was like into rock bands and
But this is when I was like four.
Well, you know, because I was working semi-illegitimately, like well before I was legally allowed to work, you know, cashiers washing cars at a car dealership.
Right.
And yeah, yeah, and I'm making great money for horrendous for the amount of work. But I went and I was into my, had my rock albums, and I really liked the Savage Garden songs. I went and bought the Savage Garden.
Yeah. Was it the one where he fucking walks up to the guitar that's suspended on wires, yeah, does the chord, and then walks away?
No, I haven't seen. I was never into Clips, man. I just remember the album. I think it was a black and white album. There's half their face on each side of the
album. Yeah, I think that's the one, man. Oh, that man, fucking film clip made me laugh. Dude, so
But then, but then the next two albums was at Park Lee Markets.
We're going to get some funny comments on these. And I'm going to join you, though, Pete. I'm going to support you. We're going to have let's have a little bit of a delve into a subject that I actually find is cool to talk about, is cheesy pop music that you shouldn't like, but you know what, god damn it, sometimes something gets through the keeper.
And you're like, you know what, man, I love pop music, it's my
there are some things that I'm like, motherfucker, you've gotten into my subconscious, and I can't deny that there is some good song composition in that.
You can't even say it's a good song, can you? You've got to pick an element and go with
Savage Garden is one of those bands for me.
Look, they're a good band.
I would not say that I fucking enjoy
guitarists use a Parker Fly guitar.
The guitarist bought out Studios 301 in Sydney. He became the next owner of it.
Really?
I think he still is, but he's not an active manager of it.
Yeah.
But I actually recorded a few bands at 301 when he was managing.
Really?
And he's a top bloke, man. Mm-hmm. He's married to Charlie from High Five.
Oh, yeah. I'd marry Charlie.
Very well done, sir. Mm. You must tip a hat.
I'd give him a high five for that.
Dude, and how much connotations would you have of being maybe not a heterosexual man, of being a member of Savage Garden?
Yeah.
That would probably be some flack that he would cop. And what a beautiful rebuttal to that.
No, not even.
We're going, may I introduce you to my wife? They're like the hottest chick on that kids' TV show.
Oh, man.
I won't go on, but well done, sir.
Yeah.
Tip of the hat. And, look, don't play Savage Garden. Don't do it.
I mean, oh, come on, man. Why not?
I'm admitting that. And it's got this cheesy 80s snare. It's like Fine Young Cannibals. She drives me crazy. This massive like tail on the snare. But there's something about that song that's it's the way that it's arranged gets into me, and it was pumped on the radio. You couldn't avoid it when it came out. You know?
And look, pop's. I like pop. And I really love my hip hop, like old school American hip hop, and these days like Aussie hip hop the last 10 years, I've got a soft spot for 90s pop, and I'm sure it's mostly nostalgia, and that's cool. I'm cool with that.
Mm.
But like, I'm just gonna say it, whatever. Okay, you can like throw shit at me.
No, it's fine.
But like the Real McCoy and like Ace of Base and like even like those cheesy ass bullshit songs.
Fucking
but
it just Ace of Base.
Horrendous songs, but they just make you.
Ace of Base was fucking massive, man. And I remember it's still the soundtrack of when I finished school and I was off my tits.
No doubt.
Was fucking when that Kylie Minogue Hot Pants song came out. It was
spinning
on
around
everywhere.
Kylie Minogue, you know, had
all that kind of shit.
Is that
and that blue song? That fucking blue song.
Spinning around.
Oh, sorry.
Get out of my way.
But all of that shit came out around the same time.
Yeah. She did get some pretty good songwriters behind her for that particular album. And that's considered.
Fuck that album. It was the Justin Timberlake album.
It's not all electronica as well. Like a lot. That song, Spinning Around, that's a proper band backing that. Mm. It sounds kind of synth poppy, but the bass and the drums in that are natural, organically tracked parts. They're not like an 808 on 4-on-4. And that's what kind of makes that a little bit more interesting to listen to and a little less grinding on the subconscious. Whereas Ace of Base,
it's cheese.
And it's manufactured cookie cutter, and the dude that's the producer is completely the wrong. And I know that's the case with most pop acts, but you know, at least I'm pretty sure Savage Garden, they were composing their own shit, you know, because yeah, they became producers of other bands. Sure. And
maybe not. You never fucking.
But yeah,
Savage Garden.
I invited the subject of cheesy pop, and now I'm giving you shit about Ace of Base. I don't mean to do that. But there are certain songs that get through to the keeper, as I say. You know, normally should shit you, and if you look at the formula of why you don't like other songs and you apply it to a song that you just somehow like, it's like, why do I like it? It should be shit, but it's like it's crept in and it's... You know what? Another good example for me is like you're a fan of hip hop and
very much, yeah.
And that I'm really not. It's got to be a I'm really not, and it's got to be a pretty amazing song. Now there are exceptions to the rule. I was a big Cypress fan. You know, I do like Cypress, but only a small slice of Cypress. Pretty much Black Sunday and what was the album after Black Sunday?
Bought them all.
With Hits and the Bong and
Skull and Bones, and that was before.
There's like two Cypress albums that I love, and it was just an era. It was a period in time that I listened to Cypress around the 90s that I love those albums. But you know, I'm not huge in. But you know what? The point I'm trying to make the poppy song that I love. That's actually. It's the Tupac song, California Love.
Oh, yeah, but that's fucking...
But that's so like that song? Popcorn, cheese, like California... Every time I hear that...
Knows how to pop.
It takes me straight back to the first time I heard it.
Listen to it and not do this.
Yeah,
you can't do it. And if you say it, you're fucking lying and you're not on the camera because it can't be done. It's just one of those songs like, fucking yes, you feel good and you just want to bob your head.
It is
true, man.
I love that song.
But you're not going to hold somebody against that. And just like, you know... I see some fucking chick going, I love this song to bloody, hey, Juvan and Mo. I'm like, I want to punch you in the face. But it's like, no, you can't hold that against song? People. No. They like what they like. And if they...
Exactly, dude.
If they, just like they can't have a go at the stuff I like.
Man, so. And but the thing is, it's all art and it's all music. And like, I remember when I was younger and I was like, before I got in, whatever, admit I was into pop or rap or whatever, but it was like, there's a whole, you get into a music, especially when you're younger, I think, well, for me, I should say, it was, you identify with what you listen to, and I was into metal and rock, like Silverchair and Metallica and fuck
yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And so you take on that personality kind of to a point, and your sayings, and like, and you soak it up, and it was like people that are into the pop culture and dance music, when that became big, it was like, you really delve into it, you know, when you get into it, but at the end of the day, it's all vibration that hits your ears and makes you feel something, man. It's all good. Like, for me, like especially these days, I can fully appreciate all music. The only music like, I can't appreciate, and no offense to, but Australian country music artists that sound Southern American, you just fuck off. But apart from that, it angers me, and it shouldn't, and that's my issue. But yeah, apart from that, it's all music, man.
It's all right to anger you as long as you're not having a go at the people that are listening to it and going, no. Whoa, fuck, are you listening to this shit?
No, listen
it's all right for you to go, man, that sounds like absolute fucking crap to me.
I think one criticism that is valid to make, and it's not necessarily the choices that people make in terms of what music they listen to, but I think some criticism is valid in terms of the mediums that they appreciate their music. A lot of people think that they're supporting the Australian music industry by watching these Voice X Factor shows, right? And the thing is that they're kind of jacking into a real love of seeing people perform live. That is something that is legit. Yeah. You know, it's awesome to do, you know, and that's what they're jacking into. But the problem is that they're kind of, you know, fucking TV gets its fucking claws into anything and they drain of it all integrity and just pump up the common denominator parts of shit. Mm. So what do? They take what is like, you know, a look. That's you know, it's inevitable with TV. It's vision. Mm. It's a visual medium. You're going to have to be somewhat kind of attractive. But the main jibe that I want to make at that is that people think that, you know, they're getting their input of live music from those shows and they don't realize that so much more enjoyment can come from actually seeing that shit in the flesh. Mm. And not only that, but not just seeing like cover acts.
Seeing like some, original work.
And it is a bit of work, you know. You might see a few things that aren't great.
You know what I noticed on those shows as well? They don't even fucking sing the whole song. They sing a verse and a chorus of the song.
Is that like,
and then they finish. Yeah. It's like, you're going to fucking try and...
That's going to be tough.
Let's see Melissa take on fucking Bruce Springsteen's greatest hit. And she does two fucking... That's half the song. Like,
yeah.
If you want to call yourself an artist, don't you have to do a whole song? Not just a section of it?
I wonder if they do the whole song and it's edited down.
No, they're all live shows. They do the fucking live shows on TV. And it's like, you know, they practice. And like, you know, it'd be nerve wracking and all that shit. But it's like, and like you said, they're taking their live feed out of this, and they're not even listening to a whole song. Like, you know, hearing the start, the build up, the bridge.
Just to throw a flip side at you, maybe some might say that could be more difficult because you don't have that intro to work up and get your voice in key or whatever.
But don't you have to, you know, hold key for longer? Isn't as a guitarist, wouldn't it be easier to do a shorter song than it is to do a longer song?
Depending on the context, because let's just say it's
the same song. Would you rather do it like? Would it be easier to do it? A intro, one verse and a chorus, then it would be to do the whole thing, the same song.
Depending on the song, because a lot of songs, like for me personally, it's how it feels to play, and sometimes like if you just skip a part, it's like, oh, that transition's fucked now because that bit's gone.
You know. I guess one justification for that would be, I'm going to know if you can nail this in a verse and a chorus. I'm not going to need much more than that.
Yeah.
As long as you give me the full range of the dynamic and the of the song, if you hit the big notes and you've got the emotive, you know, delivery in that softer verse, then, you know. But, yeah, I do see a lot of people, like, you know, people coming to me going, did you see that girl?
Oh, at
X Factor.
Fuck, man.
Adam, you've got to see it. You would be so impressed. I'm like, I'm sure I would be impressed, but it's kind of like a fast food version of that feeling, you know?
For you.
But I think that that's what they've kind of homogenized and packaged what is truly an amazing thing when you go out and see somebody perform live. And there's still people, you know, I'm not saying that people just watch X Factor and they don't go out and see shit. But, yeah, I see them kind of jacking into that feeling. And then, yeah, like I said, people will come up to you and go, did you see that performance on... And I'm like, oh, yeah, it's... Look, to be completely honest, it's the fucking young talent time. I remember young talent time. And this is all that it is. And it's just that you cycle your fucking young talent time cast way faster than what young talent time did. Mm. And at least young talent time had a bit more legs to give the careers of the people that wanted to make something some longevity. Like, do you really think we're going to get another Tina Arena out of fucking X Factor? No. You know?
It's a different age and time.
There's a guy I play in a band with.
Why do I want another Tina Arena? I don't know. She was a big Maddie, though. She still is.
Sun
still
is shining down Eastern Valley.
She's one of my celebrity passes, I'll say that.
I always thought of that when going down Eastern Valley.
Always thought the Tina Arena was a Maddie when you went down there.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I bet you that's not what she's singing about, Eastern Valley Way in Sydney.
No.
she's like massive in France.
Yeah,
she's like a French man.
That's basically why she had such a long career, is that she'd managed to jack the Europe market. And then by the time that kind of was waning a bit, she could come back as this Remember Tina Arena in Australia. But I'm pretty sure she's like a judge on one of these shows now.
I remember one of those shows, and it wasn't around for very long, but Vanessa Amorosi chick was on it.
What was her song? Give me her song.
I don't care what her song was. She was fucking tang, man. On that show, she was like glam.
I can't remember who it was. I'm just completely talking out my ass, but there was some internet rumour. Was it like... It was somebody that dated Vanessa Amorosi and came out after they broke up and said, she's got the biggest bush you've ever seen. This does not trim that shit at all. And I just can't look at her face now and not think of that.
Oh, Jungle Love, like, man. Get amongst it.
Jungle Love.
Yeah. Trim that shit, please.
All those years of free internet porn of Jada Jolene.
Get in there like a soldier.
Oh, man. Tina.
All right, so let's get into some of the subjects that I wanted to bring up in the podcast this episode. What date is it today?
14th of September.
The 14th. So, yeah, we've just gone past the 13th anniversary of 9/11. Mm. 11th of September, obviously. And I just wanted to talk a little bit about it. Now, I'm sure people are immediately going, okay, Bunzi's going to talk about some weird fucking particle accelerator ray used to... No, I'm not going down...
Weather balloons and shit and... Yeah.
Weather balloons, I don't know that
you
one.
You know, like the UFO songs back in the day, and didn't they used to, like, blame a lot of the things on weather balloons or something?
Oh, yeah,
it's
yeah.
It's one of the rabbit hole bullshit
yeah,
things.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
I don't know.
So, I'm not going to go too deep into, like, you know, the conspiracies of 9/11 and stuff like that. What I wanted to more talk about is, you know, firstly, the fact that it's been 13 years. That's fucking crazy. Like... doesn't feel like 13 years ago that I remember 9/11 going down. Like, that's it's funny. Like, it's for me, it was a watershed moment. It was one of those moments in, I'm sure for a lot of people, that will become like a benchmark. Like, you can kind of measure time based off
an anchored point in time.
Definitely, like, yeah, man. Because it was sure. such a psychological assault, the whole imagery of it, you know. That was such an impactful thing. I remember seeing on the anniversary night on SBS2 was a documentary, I've seen it a few times, called 101 Minutes That Changed America.
Really good, really good.
And it's all footage of how it went down.
Oh, with no
narration.
I think you told me about this.
Yeah, yeah. And it's done in real time, so the way that it's edited is that, like, they start the clock and then... So it's not like jumping forward and back in time. It's like every time you switch to a new bit of camera footage that they've got...
It's chronological kind of thing.
Exactly, yeah. And it's fucking eerie. And there's a scene in it, there's lots of scenes in it actually, where they're just filming people looking up at those smouldering towers. They haven't collapsed yet, but they're just looking up.
Yeah.
And just the look on the people's faces. And... yeah, when I say it was like a psychological assault, in those shots, you can actually see that psychological effect manifesting. Like, these people are just looking up, and it's like, it's almost surreal. Like, even if this was on a movie, it would be intense.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, this scene. And I just, this footage of these people just looking up, and it's like this combination of not believing what they're seeing, but then at the same time, the rational part of the brain trying to kick in and going, okay, this means that everything's different now. Like, everything's different now. You know, they just, this undeniable,
yeah,
like...
Yeah, for sure.
You know, it's like looking over and seeing, like, your own fucking house on fire, and just for that brief moment, you know, holy shit, everything's different now because my whole fucking house is on fire.
That was the thing of... I don't want to jump the gun in where this may go, but, you know, you look at all the bad shit that happens in the world, like the fucked up shit, like really bad shit happens, man. Like there's like people aren't eating food now, man.
Mm.
I'm here with my beer and like I'm going to eat food when I get home, people are fucking literally
Ebola,
like fucking
homes and wars,
like not even Ebola, like that's just an unfortunate fucked up thing as well. But I mean, like, just basic necessity
shit
of food
like that happens all the time.
Yeah, but like even food and water and. It's not a thing, right? And then I look at, I'm not downplaying the 9/11 thing at all, right? I'm just saying it was on every single fucking channel, like, for like 3 days straight. Everything was cancelled and it was pumped at us, and so it should have been. I'm not saying otherwise at all, man. Mm. But like fucking hell, when kids hit, like, people, 50,000 people die or whatever it is, like every day, and like who gives a fuck in our society? No one.
So you're kind of making the point of like, the amount of focus that happened on that, you know, there's so much other stuff that if we focused on with that intensity...
would be just as world-changing, if not, in my opinion, 10 times more, because really what the... Sorry, from my perspective and the way I look at it, the 9/11 thing made the Western rich world, if you will, give a... made ourselves... Oh, see, I don't want to maybe say anything offensive, but it was almost like victimized our whole way of life and rallied up support.
Mm.
And this is fucking wrong and that. But you look at historically, like, that was a bad thing. But in the grand, if you were to compare that to anything else that happened in the past that our country would have contributed to, like, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying it wasn't bad. I don't want anyone to think I'm saying that, because I'm fucking not.
Yeah.
But I'm saying way worse shit's happened. And I'll fucking stand by that, and way worse shit happened all the fucking time. Definitely. And everyone's like, oh, 9/11. Like, yeah, it was fucked up, and innocent people died, and it did change the world, and it gave the biggest superpower in the world, in my opinion, a reason to do many things that have eventuated. And without that, may have happened. But, like people aren't eating food, and people are talking about fucking 9/11.
Half of the shit that's happened would never have even been on the table if 9/11 hadn't happened.
For sure. And I'm not turning this into a conspiracy thing. And I'm not taking away from the conversation. Look, but if you compare it to anything else, anything in the world, it's not that fucking bad, man.
Yeah. I 100% agree. But like we were talking about the other day, it really is for us. It's for me. It feels like it's, you know, our JFK or our moon landing. It's that thing that we're going to say, you know, remember where you were.
A real seminal moment.
Yeah. And it was a bookmark moment. You know?
Can I tell you where I was?
Yeah, yeah.
And why I've always, you know, Australia, very multicultural, and depending where you live, like, and I would still say today that there's to be hints of racism and massive pockets of racism in Australia, let's be honest. And I remember, I'm jumping the gun. Where that night, I used to watch a lot of late night TV, and I was watching some comedy show, some shit was on. And then I think I was playing Mega Drive because I had an old Mega Drive. This is like 10 years after it was over, and Mega Drive but I still had one. I think I was like Afterburner. I was playing some shit, then I put TV
Afterburner, fuck yeah, man.
I was in year 8, I think, at school. Yeah, fuck yeah. I think I was in year 8 at school. And then, I was just having a late night and I was watching, and then all of a sudden something came on and this is building on fire. And I was like, fuck, man. And I was just watching it, just going, fuck. And then, like, change the channel. And every single channel
in the Australia, were playing a game and then turned it off?
And then just watching the TV. I think I used to sleep with the TV on.
Yep.
And then, just watch this thing. One of the towers hit. And then watching the other plane hit live. Or it was the illusion. Maybe it was just a replay. I'm not sure at that time. But what always stick in my mind, man, was the next day when I went to school. I fucking couldn't believe it. The racism, straight up. And, like, it's like the next, and this is what is wrong for me. The next day, everyone was just so sure what had happened. And it was never a question of who or what done this. It was, I remember, like, the next day, one of my mates and it was a bit of a racist comment. Yeah.
I was ready to fucking kill cunts.
Exactly. But because it was an attack on our way of life and you know, we're of American culture.
Poor people like you and me.
Just fucking working.
Going up into a tower.
And jumping out of the window. That was fucked up, man.
Oh my God, what about these poor people? It doesn't matter why or who. These poor fucking people jumping out of buildings and like, believe it.
Fucked up, right?
Completely
fucked up. But what, you know, I think, and I'm not taking away from the fucked upness of that, but what was more fucked up for me was going to school the next day and people, I'm just quoting here, we've got to, you know, get the Arabs and like full races.
I wasn't that full on, but I was of the same mindset.
This might make more sense. I went to a private Christian school. So, naturally, and I don't care what anyone says, it's a separatist movement, and it is.
I went to Redlands, I agree.
Man, I played in church bands until I was 15, and this is my opinion. And everyone was very much like that. And I remember classes, whole classes, we were just watching the news reports for the whole day.
Really?
What the fuck? Like, that's wrong in itself. That is wrong. That's commandeering the minds of young people, in my opinion.
Okay. You know? All right. Let me say a few things about that. So I totally hear what you're saying about how if you're talking about numbers of people that died during 9/11, and if you're stacking that up against the atrocities of the world, then it actually isn't that big a deal. In terms of pure numbers, right?
Okay, yeah.
I totally am on par with you
with that. In other respects,
there was things that were fucking so much more massive that I totally agree should have gotten media coverage, that were so intense that, you know what, probably justified cutting from normal programming directly to a live feed and going, look at what's going on in Somalia. The shit that went down in Somalia during the 90s is like a modern day Holocaust levels of fucking death.
Yeah, man. You know, disgusting.
It's fucking incredible.
It's absolutely disgusting.
That, and there were reports on it, but they were like fucking fringe reporters and like fucking, yeah. You had to seek that shit out. It wasn't on the everyday news of look at what's happening. Like another, like 100,000 people died this week.
Mm.
Like crazy numbers like that. And I agree that that should have, you know, if that kind of stuff gets more coverage, then there would be way less acceptance of it. However, I would say that the intensity of 9/11, I don't think that there really had been anything as intense as that in terms of, like, however you think that went down, whether the government had a hand in it or if they knew that it might be going down and they kind of weren't as diligent as they should be, right through the spectrum to exactly the story that is the official story is exactly how it went down.
Mm.
However you look at it like that, I don't think that anything that visually intense has happened. And the other thing is, it was a kind of a perfect marriage of a time where worldwide live broadcasting was really like up to scratch and high definition cameras were like all pointed, you know, were ready to be broadcast, you know. Like, yeah, like I remember Waco. That was probably a kind of an equivalent thing where, in terms of the intensity of something... Your antivirus just updated.
Yeah, I think so.
I'm not sure about Waco. Is that like a...
Waco was the David Koresh guy that basically had a compound of, like, people. He was basically proclaiming that he was the next Messiah.
Oh, yeah.
And he convinced this whole compound of people to fucking join him.
Yeah. Was that in America, yeah?
Yeah, Texas. Waco, yeah. Texas.
Yeah.
And... the FBI basically stormed his compound and it was fucked up and the whole thing was broadcast live on CNN.
Mm.
And it was tanks coming into this fucking, you know, I'm pretty sure they had guns, but they didn't have fucking, like...
RPGs and shit.
No. So they brought in the tanks, and they were there's like famous footage of the tanks punching through windows, and then once they've punched through the window, they just fucking... tear gas the shit, and apparently heaps of people died just from like tear gas exposure, which is apparently one of the most fucking fucked up ways to die. I'm dead because I inhaled that. It's like fucking like 5 to 10 minutes of your insides pulverizing and liquefying, and you know, then you die, you know. And that there was kids and shit that they did that too, you know. And they set the place on fire as well. I think a lot of people died, but the reason I bring that up is that, like, that was a major event that was broadcast live to the world. Like, they cut what was happening live on TV and went to this feed. But, you look at the footage these days, and it's low-res, grainy, you know, like, kind of feels like in the past when you look at it. It's like you're separated from it.
Yeah.
But fucking 9/11, man, that was high def. That was live. I'll get into the where I was when I saw it. But look, I just want to finish. I totally agree with your point. I'm not rebutting your point that there are other major things that have happened in this world that should get the coverage.
I do agree.
And should get the amount of, you know. But 9/11, nothing like that had ever happened before.
That was presented to the world on a platter, man, like, in terms of, like, that was just ready to be consumed. Because it was that marriage of maybe the time and the technology and
whatever. If you believe the official story, then, and, like, you know, the terror, Al-Qaeda... the terrorists were completely in control of what went down, then they were actually quite smart about it because, and that's what the official story says, that they jacked that first plane and deliberately put that first plane into the first building, the first tower, so the world would turn all of their cameras, every camera would be pointed, and then the second plane plows in live on TV. Everyone's, the whole world's watching it. It's not like, oh, you know, update, you know, turn your TV on now. Like, everyone was watching when that second plane went in.
Yeah.
So if you believe the whole story of, like, they were going for a psychological assault, then that was part of their plan, is to have, like, everyone looking at it.
Fucking brutal. Like, that footage of the fireball at the other end of the fucking building that it hits. Fuck, man.
Have we ever seen anything like that in the history of the world?
You know,
will we ever see anything? I hope we don't, but I just think that is the most intense thing that generations of humankind will ever fucking experience, and I hope it never happens again in any kind of capacity.
I suppose I'd agree with you, man, but I think the only reason it was this I don't mean bad, but big, was purely because it was given the attention. And if anything else had been given the attention, I think we'd be having the same conversation.
Perhaps. And
in my opinion.
But
then it was attack on home soil of the most... Yeah,
suicide bombers are fucked up shit, but, you know, like... I can't even quantify how... The emotions it brings up on me, even when I watch the footage to this day,
it takes me back to when I was watching it, and it's just like you want to do something, but you can't do anything.
It's even the amount of times I've seen the footage and talked about it. It's still a part of my brain that can't quite wrap it around that went down, that actually fucking happened. It's fucking intense, man. But I understand what you're saying, and I'm agreement with you. Other shit should get the coverage. And
but I'm in agreement with you, though.
You know what? Even to go like extended that. On that idea, if we had been more diligent and talking about shit more detailed, like you're talking about, maybe we could have avoided this shit, or maybe the fucking public could have been a bit more, like, you know, aware of what happens.
Mm-hmm.
What happens when...
Full middle wipe, do a big middle wipe. Yeah.
What happens when you're not aware of fucking, you know, what leads to this shit, and it won't be such a shock when this kind of shit goes down. But
I'm definitely not downplaying, and
I agree with you though, I understand. I know that you're not saying trying to downplay 9/11 by what
that
you're saying.
That was fucked up by any measure. You can measure that against anything, anything in the world, and that's fucked up. You know, but in my opinion...
I hear you, man.
In my opinion, like 50,000 kids dying every day is way more fucked up. Sorry.
Definitely.
It just is. It's way more fucked up.
But, okay, not to excuse that, but that's sort of like a product of a broken global system. Whereas this is something that was
hesitant to say it, but it's kind of like it's almost... like you're not really surprised that it happens in some of these places.
But how is anyone not surprised that happened? Like, but imagine like fucking
that's
everyone's
not a place that you expect that amount of people are going to be killed in that kind of fashion.
I
think that's what makes it a bit more shocking.
I disagree with that, and only because, like, historically, just look at the record, man. Like, America fucks everyone's ass straight up. Like I said, and this isn't even conspiracy theory shit. This is just what happens. Watch the fucking news, man. That's just what happens. So for them to... And I'm not saying it was justified. It was fucked. That should never happen. That should never happen again. But for that to have happened and people say, oh, I never saw that coming. Really? Did you really never see that? Did you honestly never see that coming?
But to see that... Or maybe not like... something like that, I could see repercussions coming against America as being likely, yes. But something like that, I wouldn't have been able to think that up.
Yeah, I agree. I think that there was a sense of, you know, you reap what you sow, and America is overstepping a lot of areas, pissing off a lot of very extreme groups. Like, there was a time where, you know...
A lot of chest beating.
And still to this day, it's like it's not like a open dialogue at all. It's like, bring it on. You know, recently Joe Biden came out and talked about how they're going to deal with ISIS/ISIL, the Islamic State.
Yeah.
And he's like, you know what, we'll fight them to the gates of hell, because that's where they're going to have to hide, that's where they'll be, is in hell. And we'll, like, all of this fucking rhetoric, it means nothing, no actual real fucking facts in what you're saying. But and you're stirring up this emotion of, you know, and that's irresponsible, because it's basically off the back of this fucking kind of event. And to continually jacking people's emotion on this kind of shit. Like, talk sensibly, you fucking dumb fuck. You're the vice president, and you're talking about gates of hell?
Yeah,
like, you fucking idiot.
Yeah, man.
Like, it annoys me, you know? And didn't we learn from the kind of shit that fucking, like, Bush fucking, you know, bring it on, you know? We will fuck... they want to fucking attack us. They want to attack our bases, bring it on. And, like, the fucking 2 months after he said that... So many fucking Americans got killed. So many bases. They did. They brought it on. They fucking will do that shit. Yeah. You know? Like,
did you see the thing the other day with Obama?
Warmongering fucking idiots, man. Like,
did you see
seriously?
Obama give his speech the other day about ISIS, who's going to take him down?
I did. We actually watched.
What a fucking cocksucker. Sorry, no offense to him. But like, no, all offense to him. You cocksucker, Obama. Fuck. And, like, and he's there for just perpetuating death and hate. And it's just like... Man, like,
some of the language was pretty accelerated.
Yeah, but where did it end up last time? And then he's just fucking doing the same thing again. Like, and but then again, like, I think ISIS. I only know what I read, or read on the internet. So how the fuck do I really know when I really don't?
Yeah, yeah.
And I can watch all the Vice documentaries and all the fucking. In the, it doesn't matter, man.
Yeah,
I'm not there. I haven't spoken to the citizens.
I'm a big fan. I recommend if you want to, and to people that are listening to the podcast, I'm always one to promote other podcasts. And one that I highly recommend to you, Pete, and to people that are listening that are interested in learning a bit about the whole Islamic State situation and what to do about it with a level head is Dan Carlin. He's a guy called Dan Carlin. He's got a podcast called Common Sense. He's also got another podcast called Hardcore History.
Mm-hmm.
But Common Sense is the one where he actually talks about, like, week to week, or not week to week, it only comes out every few weeks, but current events. And he's been focusing on this Islamic State issue recently. I won't spoil it, but people go seek out that podcast. It's really good analysis on the situation, and overall look at what he's basically surmising is that maybe what's going down is a natural rebuttal, a natural redrawing of borders that were drawn after the World War that were artificially imposed in that area that didn't actually make sense with the actual, you know, different factions that were living in that area. And this is it, plus the whole, like, Iraq war being a quagmire and us funding fucking, you know, rebels that we shouldn't fund, and, you know, giving weapons to fucking the Iraq police that basically at the fucking sight of these guys coming over the hill dropped everything and bailed, and now all of a sudden the guys coming over the hill have got all of the guns that we just tried to give the police, that we set up their own security forces, all of that. But plus that, this is a natural reshaping of the borders, because this was something that the West imposed on that area after the World War and said, okay, here's now your new, you know, this is, like, all of those are fucking imposed on them, and it never worked. There was, like...
I'm not going to get into it, but, yeah, like, well, I'm not going to get into it because, you know, obviously, it's like, fuck, no matter what I say about it, you know, I'm wrong. But the, Israel, could you imagine you lived in Palestine, and all of us, like, imagine, like, all of a sudden, like, oh, I don't know, like, fucking with an African group of people just fucking planted here. And then you know, like,
Israel and Palestine's a tough one. I don't
want to talk about it because I don't know enough about it. I'm not researched on enough.
It's something I've tried to read stuff about, and it just seems that that's really a subject that has vested interests. Whatever you're reading seems to have a very vested
interest. You can't get an unbiased view.
And that's why I recommend Dan Carlin. He also looks at that situation as well. But the point I was making before is basically this could be a natural thing that needs to happen. As fucked up as what's happening in that area, maybe there needs to be a period of fucking fucked upness for there to be some kind of natural border resemblance forming in that area, right? And when he talks about us, maybe the West, maybe needing to not intervene in this, and as fucked up as the shit that we're seeing out coming out, and as good as their video production is in terms of, you know, editing their fucking Islamic State videos and shit, maybe the West needs to just let some shit go down there and these natural borders reform, and then it'll be a bit more of a stable region. And part of the reasoning that he gives for why it wouldn't be not such a bad thing for us to not intervene, but why some of the rhetoric coming out as to why we need to do something now about the Islamic State might be a bit misgiven, is he's like, if you actually look at what Saddam did in that same region, it was just as gnarly. It was just as full on. He had, like, rape rooms set up around different places where he just fucking take people in and make, like, the father watch guards rape the daughter and shit.
Oh, that's just fucking...
And fucking, you know, so we're the beheadings are fucking gnarly, but what Saddam was doing was, like, on a whole nother level of a whole nation, you know, gnarly. And he was just an accepted evil, you know, because he kept shit together. He kept shit... Like, as gnarly as the stuff that he was doing, look at the gnarliness that's happening now without a dominant power in that region. And so, yeah, all of this is, they're big subjects that I don't have the education to really talk about.
I know nothing about them.
That's why I'm recommending Darren Cullen and Common Sense as a podcast.
Yeah.
He spends his life looking at this kind of shit, and it's no doubt a biased opinion. Everything's got some kind of bias to it.
Of course.
But it feels like he's got a good bird's eye view of the situation and not sort of investing too much emotion into one side of politics or one side of left and right kind of thing. Yeah,
well, the great paradox would be, you know, the unbiased opinion.